Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey everybody, it's Kai, and just Kai, sorry, Molly's out. We are going to be back regular time Tuesday to talk about The Man in the High Castle, but I have decided that we are going to do a segment today because A, we need to, B, you guys got upset when we said we weren't going to, D, or maybe C, I forget, I read this piece in New York Magazine I want to talk about, and also we have to because you guys expect us to be here, and that's what we're going to do. What we're going to talk about today, for the most part, is Facebook because it is unbelievable right now what is going on with that company. First of all, its reach and its breadth and its the extent to which it hits this economy, but also the politics of the thing and Mark Zuckerberg and how that company thinks about itself. We could, as I'm sure you know, have this conversation about Twitter or Google or Amazon or Microsoft or Apple. Any and all of those companies have our data. They have our money. They have our location. They have so many things about us. But Facebook is a little different, and here's why. 2 billion monthly users. That's why. 1.3 billion people use the freaking service every day. Just to give you some numbers here, Twitter, about 330-ish million monthly users, 68 million of whom are in the United States. So Facebook is, by an order of magnitude, more significant, more important, more relevant, and in some senses more disruptive to our lives, this society, and the economy. A prime user of all of these social media things, the president of the United States, and what he says gets amplified. The Russian government likes to use Facebook, as we know. So we are going to talk about all of that stuff. There was an article in New York Magazine that I want to talk about called Does Even Mark Zuckerberg Know What Facebook Is? It was written by a guy by the name of Max Reed. He's a senior editor at New York Magazine. Max, welcome to Make Me Smart.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things you talk about in this piece, and it is, I will say, for those who don't have a lot of time to read things these days, this is a long one, but it is well worth your time. How did you set about framing your reporting for this article? Because Facebook, as you say in this piece, is an unwieldy beast.
So the genesis of this piece was this tour that Mark Zuckerberg has been taking across the country. He, at the beginning of the year, he set a personal challenge for himself to have visited every state before the end of the year. And so, you know, we sort of set off to do a kind of a regular magazine piece that was just, what's he up to? What's he doing? And as we started to research it and report it out, it became clear that we didn't really have the language or the terms to talk about what exactly he was up to. It was very easy to say, you know, oh, he's presaging a presidential run. But Facebook is such a weird company and such an enormous company that it didn't really seem adequate to say, you know, oh, he wants to be president. Or even to say, you know, oh, you know, he already has as much power as a president. Because saying something like that is a kind of crazy thing to say. And so we decided the best way to do it was to ask the question, you know, if we don't know what Facebook is, are we sure that Mark Zuckerberg knows what it is?
Do we think Zuckerberg knows what it is? I mean, he's got some ideas. He's written a manifesto that you talk about in this piece called Building a Global Community. It runs like 6,000 words. So he's clearly got some thoughts on what it is he's trying to do here.
Yeah, I mean, I think he has a perspective on Facebook. I think we all do. I think what's kind of difficult to talk about is that it's so big that my given perspective, my sense of what it is as I use it, is different from someone else's. And it's not just that I, as a user, have a different perspective. It's that the U.S. government, as an institution or a body, has a different perspective, as charities that use it, as political parties that use it. Each one of them uses it in different ways and thinks about it in different ways. So I think Zuckerberg knows what it is in a bunch of different senses. But I don't think that any one of us right now can really sort of grasp it in its totality, just because of its size.
There was a piece in, we're taping this on a Thursday. There was a piece, I think, in the New York Times today in which there was either a quote or this was the point of the op-ed is Facebook too big to be regulated? I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit here in this conversation, but one of the things that's been happening as a result of the Russian involvement in the election, and as a result, frankly, of Zuckerberg and Facebook's intransigence in coming clean about what they know about Russian involvement in Facebook in this election, that's one of the things that's gotten them in trouble. Is it possible to regulate this company, to wrap our arms around this company in a way that it will not just do what it wants willy-nilly, which is what it's been doing so far?
Sure. I mean, I would say technically, absolutely, it's possible to regulate Facebook, you know, but it also requires the political will to do so. It requires some creative, legal, and regulatory thinking about what Facebook is and how it could best be regulated. You know, from the perspective of the Russian ads problem, that's a problem where there already is a significant body of regulatory law about how we deal with political ads on broadcast networks, that it would be relatively simple to sort of shift over to the internet. You know, in particular, the idea that foreign governments can't purchase political ads. Mm. But sort of the broader problem of bringing 2 billion people together in ways that the planet has never really experienced before, I'm not sure that we have yet thought through the consequences of what that is and therefore, you know, how best to regulate it or deal with it. Mm. It's not like Ma Bell where you just break it up into 5 regional pieces. It's not like broadcasters where you just put some really stringent rules about what can and can't be said on it. So it's that combination of sort of thinking through what Facebook is in order to figure out what to do about it, and then also making sure that there actually is a political will to do it among users and citizens and politicians.
You know, but you point out in this piece that Facebook now is, in essence, a transnational actor, right? It has almost the powers of a sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
It has, and these are your words, this is a great phrase, it's got planetary technical systems, right? I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be so gargantuan and ginormous that because your experience is different than my experience is different than, you know, anybody else's experience, that adds a layer of complexity that is almost insurmountable.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the major challenges of the 21st century is figuring out how these planetary technical systems, of which Facebook is just one, you know, Google is another one, Amazon and Apple both sort of approach that size and that scope, how the kind of the states that we recognize as the main sovereign entities on the planet grapple with those and with the consequences of them. You know, and I try to be optimistic as hard as it is in 2017. You know, the U.S. government still has the army and the nuclear arsenal. So at least Facebook doesn't have that yet. Servers are still mostly located in the U.S. Like physically, the U.S. government has the power to take on Facebook if it needs to. It's really a matter of grasping this as a problem and addressing it. And where it's easy to get pessimistic is if you wake up every day and you open Facebook on your phone, what you see is like a collection of your friends and birthday reminders and stuff. And it's difficult to think about that in terms of something that might genuinely be a threat to an open liberal democratic society.
About that liberal democratic society, you write here that after the election, Zuckerberg was amazed at the wreckage that his invention had brought to liberal democratic society. And he initially was extremely skeptical of his company's impact.
Yeah, you know, I don't know Zuckerberg well. I can't speak to what's in his head, but he definitely, I think, has trouble thinking through the negative consequences of what Facebook does, because in part just because as the CEO, he has to be a true believer in it being a force for good in the world. And I think part of this tour and part of his evolving set of statements about it over the last year has been him slowly sort of publicly coming to terms with the idea that Facebook is not simply, you know, that merely connecting people is not enough to be a force for good in the world. That in fact, sometimes connecting people can be bad and can wreck institutions that are necessary for the smooth functioning of civic society.
If we don't understand what Facebook is, and I'm talking the grand we here, and if Mark Zuckerberg specifically doesn't really understand what Facebook hath wrought, what are the consequences? What happens?
Well, I mean, one thing that I've been saying is, you know, as I've been writing in digital media now for 8 or 9 years, and I sort of witnessed Facebook sweep through media around 2011 and 2012. And especially if you were working as a blogger, if you were working in sort of purely digital media, but also in print and everywhere else, Facebook really sort of tore everything up, that it was offering sort of an audience size that we had never really seen before. And a lot of businesses really transformed the way they worked in order to sort of worship at that altar, to suck as much of that audience as they possibly could. And then Facebook decided, sort of by fiat, that it no longer really wanted to work as closely with publications. Mm-hmm. It didn't want to weight links as high on algorithms, and all of a sudden, all that audience disappeared. And you know, to me, that's not a unfamiliar dynamic. I mean, that's not a dynamic. That's a dynamic that could very easily be replicated across all kinds of businesses and institutions. And the one that worries me in particular is the kind of civic fabric of society. So that if Facebook becomes the organizing principle for local community groups, for political parties, for the kinds of, you know, bodies that make up like general daily political life in this country, by offering the sort of organizational tools and the scale that it does, it can really change the way they work. And then if it walks away in some way, or changes it, or transforms it, you know, it's a little bit like giving Facebook the keys to your church, or or otherwise giving it a little bit too much power in things that we don't want it to do. You know, what that specifically means, I don't know. It's as with Facebook, I have trouble predicting exactly. I just know that I don't quite trust it to transform the world for good anymore.
Which is a deeply troubling thing to hear from a guy who spent a long time reporting this piece and has thought deeply about this company. What do you suppose happens then in the short to medium term as we continue being politically divided in this country, as Mark Zuckerberg and or Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of that company, wind up in front of some Senate committee saying, what the hell is going on? And those two say, I don't know, we're just trying to do good and get people to join together in the world. You know,
I think in the short term, I think we will see some real regulatory action, at least around political ads, which I think is a good thing. You know, it's important to set up these kinds of institutional frameworks to deal with this stuff. The question is whether or not that is just, you know, that's the start of a movement to install better regulation across these companies, or whether it's just it's one and done and then they walk away. You know, the latter is sort of the worst case scenario, because that means that Facebook feels like it's been regulated. Facebook feels like it's been dealt with. People hear that Facebook has been dealt with. But the sort of under the churning that goes on underneath the like explicit foreign government interference, which is the sort of hyper-partisan news that pushes news coverage to one pole or the other, and sort of the way it's able to organize groups that otherwise would have trouble organizing offline, that doesn't get dealt with. And that just keeps pushing us into a further part, a more partisan society. It makes elections more difficult to sort of predict and to deal with. And, you know, absent we as a society and theoretically the government that represents us standing up and saying we need to think very carefully about this, there needs to be some kind of public advocacy dealing with this, I don't see why 2016 couldn't be replicated over and over and over again.
You know, that's so interesting. And once again, I'll use this word. It's distressing to hear these words coming out of your mouth, because one of the things you talk about in this piece is Zuckerberg on the 21st-ish of September, when he came back from paternity leave. He did this Facebook Live. It went like 8 or 10 minutes. And he said, listen, I get it. We're going to get better at this. We're going to disclose, blah, blah, blah. And then he said, in almost this language, we are protecting democracy in the upcoming German elections. And which you point out correctly is an amazing thing for a private company to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's and the thing what's just as amazing as it's saying it is how natural it feels for Facebook to say and think that Facebook understand itself not as a private company, you know, that operates on the field of democracy, but as the field on which democracy itself operates. And it has not demonstrated to us that it can be trusted with that kind of power and responsibility.
What is there a gesture he could make? I mean, just to sort of wrap this up, is there a gesture you think Zuckerberg could make, or the company could make, that would, and I guess we don't want gestures, right? We want substantive change. What could he do to make people, God, I sound like, I don't even know what I sound like, to make people believe again, you know?
Well, I mean, this is going to be a little bit out there, but I was reading about Charles V last night, who was the Holy Roman Emperor and the King of Spain at the same time.
Charles V, okay.
Yeah, and he was too powerful in the European political sphere. He was at war all the time because he owned all the Spanish colonies. He ruled over the territories that made up the Holy Roman Empire, and he abdicated. You know, he walked away. He gave Spain to his brother, and he gave the Holy Roman Empire to his son, and he restored, essentially, the balance of power on the continent. I'm glossing over it a little bit, but I think the point is that there's precedent for kings stepping down, for people with that kind of power, that kind of sovereign power, saying, you know what, I have too much. I need to walk away. So maybe the version of that I would say Zuckerberg could do that would solve a lot of this is saying, you know what, I'm going to turn Facebook into an enormous nonprofit. I want to bring people together. I want to make them work, but I'm going to do this from the point of view of solely of making the world a better place and not for profit. Yeah. Do I think he's actually going to do that? No. I would be happy if he just released the Russian ads to the public, frankly. But, you know, in my dream world, tomorrow he'd give a speech from the Facebook Vatican and say, Facebook's a nonprofit now.
Max Reed, it's a piece called Does Even Mark Zuckerberg Know What Facebook Is in New York Magazine. We've got a link to it on our website. It's, I'll tell you what, with all that's going on, it's a thoughtful piece. Max, thanks a bunch.
Thanks so much, Kai.
All right, we'll be back in a minute. First, though, we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
We had all kinds of fun, Molly Wood and I did last week, answering your questions on our Explain-a-thon. We're going to do another one probably a couple of months, maybe. We'll make it a regular thing because, honestly, it totally was fun. There are still many, many questions left to answer, so we're going to get to some of them.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
Okay, I lied. Technically, we're going to get to one of them. It comes from John Kreider. And it is about the subject du jour in economic policy in Washington these days, taxes. Here you go.
I understand how reducing taxes can increase profitability. Can you help me understand how reducing taxes increases growth? If I have a lemonade stand and I have 10 customers that are generating a dollar in revenue a day and I go to zero taxes, how does that get me more customers for my lemonade stand?
All right, John, so here we go. First of all, thanks for the question. Good luck with the lemonade stand. It's not about getting you more customers for your lemonade stand. That's not what the deal is, right? The theory goes that if taxes are cut, and we're not talking actually sales taxes here, right, which is what you're referring to with lemonade stands, but if people's income taxes are cut, the theory, and corporate taxes as well, and I'll break those out in a second, but the theory is that if you cut taxes, if you reduce the amount of money that the government takes out of people's paychecks, people will then spend that money. And that money generates growth. And it's not just people buying more lemonade from you. It's going down to the store and buying a sweater. It's buying a car. It's fixing the roof on their houses. It's whatever they're going to do with it that gets spread throughout the economy. So it's not about a business-specific thing. Tax cuts are not designed to get, you know, Amazon specifically more customers. It's about the aggregate economic gain that happens when the tax-paying public has more money in its pocket. So That's in a very general sense the consumer side of tax cuts. The business side of tax cuts is a different animal. As you know, the administration and Republicans in Congress are talking about cutting the corporate tax rate in this country from 35%, which is the statutory rate, although nobody pays that, down to 20%, which would be an amazingly huge, ginormous, beautiful, awesome tax cut, if I could paraphrase the president. The theory then would be that those companies would use that extra money that they have by not paying taxes to make capital investments, build new plants, hire more people, make more products that then consumers who, oh, by the way, also get a tax cut, can then buy. The catch is that, and just to bring it all full circle here, that's not what happens when companies get tax cuts. Typically, what they do is they do stock buybacks, they increase their dividends, they sit on the money and wait for really attractive investment opportunities, not always capital investments, sometimes mergers and acquisitions. And consumers, sometimes consumers don't spend that money, right? There's a not small slice of economics called behavioral economics, which is all about what people do given economic stimuli or restraints. And the problem is, if you're writing tax policy, and Paul Ryan would back me up on this if we could get him on this program, that you can't always figure out what people are going to do. So in a nutshell, tax cuts are about growth. They are not about more customers for your lemonade stand. It's more the aggregate than the specific. And there we go. That's tax cuts and lemonade stands. You can go to our website, by the way, at makemesmart.org and find the answer to the single solitary question that I did not know the answer to when we did the explain-a-thon. It was about the sequester, which is, by the way, still there. We punted it to Tony Wagner on our digital team, and he wrote a post called What You Need to Know About the Sequester and Trump. And it's actually interesting because the sequester is still out there. The budget is in the news. And oh, by the way, so is the president. All right. So that's it. Book club episode on Tuesday. Man in the High Castle. Tune in. Interesting little sneak peek on my thought of this. The TV series was way better than the book, but I thought the book was really interesting. You got to send us those voice memos and stuff like now. So please do that. You can email them to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org, and they will get to us. And we're out. Bye. All right, we are going. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music is and was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive producer of Marketplace is Tar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm all kinds of lonely here with nobody to kibitz as our theme music runs out, which is kind of a drag. Oh, wait, we got the short version. No kibitzing required. Bye.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.